Hello, and welcome to the Health Foundation podcast. I'm your host, Jennifer Dixon. In this podcast, we explore key issues affecting health and healthcare, and always with terrific guests. Today, we're talking about that vexed issue, funding the NHS.
We realised that we were going to have to fund the National Health Service in a significantly bigger way, not just for a few years, but in the years to come, when we received the Wanless report.
It's very easy to forget the state the service was in 20 years ago. Long waiting lists, heart-rending cases delayed, winter crises, and widespread debate on whether the NHS model was finally kaput. But an interview with Prime Minister Tony Blair on Prime Sunday Morning TV changed everything. He made a pledge to bring healthcare spending up to the European average in GDP terms by 2006. The surprise announcement on BBC Breakfast with Frost by Blair in January 2000 set civil servants scrambling to work out what it meant. Bounced by this so-called preemptive strike by the Prime Minister, the Treasury commissioned a review of NHS funding, the so-called Wanless Review. Now almost two decades old, it was the first serious attempt to assess the 20-year future funding needs of the National Health Service. It unlocked not only uniquely high levels of investment for the NHS, but crucially helped to justify the tax rises to pay for it. There hasn't been anything similar since. As we come out of the pandemic, we face the twin challenge of a backlog in need for care, plus high pressure on the public purse given the hit from the pandemic. So the question we're asking today is it time for another Wanless? To help us answer this, I'm delighted to welcome two guests who were very close to the original Wanless Review and both seasoned former Treasury officials. Anita Charlesworth is Director of the REAL Centre here at the Health Foundation. Anita led the Secretariat for the original Wanless Review within the Treasury, where she was Director of Public Spending between 1998 and 2007.
Healthcare is part of our critical national infrastructure. And we need a system that's more resilient, and you just don't create resilience overnight.
And Nick McPherson, or I should say Baron McPherson of Earl's Court, served as the Permanent Secretary to the Treasury from 2005 to 2016 and was Permanent Secretary to three Chancellors. He also managed the department through the financial and wider economic crisis beginning in 2007 and joined the House of Lords in 2016.
Generally, when politicians want to make a radical change, the last people they would consult is the Treasury, who would always tell you about 17 reasons why this was really a very bad idea and you should continue as you are at the moment.
So let's kick off. Looking back and reading around this issue for this podcast, I was really taken aback by the febrile environment that was early 2000. About the state of the NHS. So at that point, I was the policy advisor to the then chief executive of the NHS, Alan Langlands. And I remember watching with him a very distressing BBC News in January, where the distressing case of Mavis Skeet was there, where this 74-year-old lady who had cancer, unfortunately, had her surgery cancelled by Leeds General Infirmary four times and then told that the cancer was inoperable. And I was watching this with Alan and we were just seared by this particular case, but it was one of many, wasn't it? So I just wondered if I could ask you both where you were in 2000 and what you remember about that rather febrile time.
Yeah, I think one of the things that was interesting then was up until the mid-1990s, people generally thought that the NHS, once you waited quite a long time for care, was a really efficient system. You know, it provided universal coverage, it was pretty good. But we started to get data on outcomes, and we started to get international comparative data on outcomes. And it was pretty clear that the NHS wasn't really a crown jewel. It was more than tarnished. And we were spending less than other countries. We might have been more efficient because, you know, we didn't have high admin costs, but actually we were getting worse outcomes. And in things like cancer and all the big killers, heart disease, infant mortality as well, things were pretty shocking when you compared us internationally. So you couldn't argue that this was cheap, but that was because it was just more efficient. It was cheap, possibly efficient, but actually poorer quality all round. And that, I think, was quite important in shifting a lot of medical debate and senior NHS leaders debate, because it wasn't just individual stories. There was this clear data showing that we had a very, very significant problem.
Yes, and I remember Robert Winston also pulling at that point about the care of his 87-year-old mother. Funding in the NHS was not as good as Poland, I seem to remember him saying. Nick, was this your recollection about that period?
Yes. The NHS had been a bone of political contention throughout the late 80s and most of the 1990s. But the new Labour government was elected in 1997 with a mandate to improve public services. I mean, as it happened, they inherited some pretty tough public spending plans from Ken Clark, which Ken never meant to implement himself. But Gordon Brown, to show that, to prove his credibility as a chancellor, committed to those plans. Now, actually, the NHS did get more money in the late 90s, but it was becoming increasingly clear that it wasn't enough. And 3 years into that Labour government, I think Tony Blair, no doubt reflecting wider public opinion, took the view that he needed to make some bigger commitment.
Yeah, I mean, you get the impression reading the headlines at the time, not only did they have the winter flu crisis, but then they had this terrible story of Mavis Skeet. It was kind of inevitable that something was going to happen. And then, but to go on Breakfast with Frost and make a surprise announcement that even Tony Blair's advisor at the time, Robert Hill, didn't know about, it's quite interesting. And to inject at least 12 billion of extra money over the next 6 years and to get the spending up to the European average by 2006, that's a monumental. So in a sense, it was pressure was building, wasn't it, politically, and something needed to happen because the rap in the press was so huge. Most papers weren't supporting the NHS at that point, it seemed.
Yes, I mean, look, it didn't totally surprise me that Blair did make that commitment without telling anybody. Generally, when politicians want to make a radical change, the last people they would consult is the Treasury, who would always tell you about 17 reasons why this was really a very bad idea and you should continue as you are at the moment. And so it was a genuinely radical suggestion. My guess is that those of us in the Treasury, and I can't quite remember my reaction to it, objected to it because it was basically an input target. Saying you're just going to spend a whole lot more, you know, is only part of the solution. And if you're a Treasury official, you immediately start worrying about how you're going to pay for it. And I think that's really what then informed what happened next. You know, allegedly Gordon Brown got very angry, realized that this was kind of the way the wind was blowing, and actually that the Treasury did need to react. But being Gordon Brown, he realised that the way to do this was to set up a review, which would be Treasury. And I think it's against that background. I went along to see Anita, who was minding her own business, working on Welfare to Work, very effectively, as I remember, to tell her that actually her time had come and that it was time that she went and worked for this man, Derek Wanless.
So, Anita, your thoughts there would be quite interesting. I mean, there is the question, if Blair had said, look, we're going to get up to the European average by 2006, you have to then say, well, why a Wanless? But Nick's given some clues as to why. What was your recollection?
I think there were two reasons why you then wanted to do this. One is, Nick said this was an input target. And actually, the politics of the day, I think, with New Labour, was that, actually Gordon Brown was a spender, obviously, despite holding to Ken Clark's figures in 97. But he had this very strong sense of, with some of his phrases, prudence with a purpose and rights and responsibilities, and that actually there needed to be something for something, and that people didn't like, and it was bad for Labour for there to be spending commitments that were very open-ended, where it wasn't clear where that how they were going to be funded, and it wasn't clear what you'd get for it. But a review by the Treasury is quite a bad way of doing that, because the Treasury coughs up the money and raises the revenue, but it then doesn't actually run the health service. It's for the Department of Health and the NHS. And I think that, you know, the big weakness of OneNurse was that although they were involved, it was a very consultative process. It was never owned by them. And so actually, once the money was forthcoming, the ambition and agenda that the OneNurse Review set out for the NHS was never really taken forward by anyone. And that's the problem with independent reviews. Their strength is that they can take a step back and look at things independently. Their weakness is that the people who actually then have to do something with it don't really feel any great attachment to anything other than the money.
Yeah, and we'll come back to that, I think. It's a very important point. Could you just, for those who are less long in the tooth than we are, chart the contours of the terms of reference. What did OneNurse actually cover and what didn't it cover, very importantly?
Well, the original terms of reference, there were a couple of things. It was asked to look at really the funding that was needed, recognising that in healthcare, it's like Lewis Carroll, it's the Red Queen. You have to run to stand still. Population grows, it ages, there's rising chronic disease, and most critically, medicine can do ever more. So you have to try and work out what does technological advance look like? What does the changing nature of our population look like? What does that mean then for the funding that we'd need to deliver a comprehensive service? That was its primary task. It wasn't actually tasked with looking at, is a tax-funded NHS in itself a good idea initially? The other thing that wasn't in the terms of reference of OneNurse and was his regret and would definitely, I think, if you were doing this again, be something you'd really look at was social care. So it was very narrowly the NHS.
Yes, and Nick, this OneNurse came hard on the heels, didn't it, of the Sutherland review into social care and funding of. So presumably, I seem to remember that was a very fraught report itself, wasn't it, that was published in 1999?
Yes, it was. And actually, even within the commission, there was a minority report. And actually, the Sutherland Commission is just one of, you know, many reviews of social care, the most recent one being the Dilnot one, where, you know, it's always going to be the answer to life, the universe and everything. And then it arrives and then nothing happens. And I mean, OneNurse did make a recommendation that you really did need to look at social care, but as Anita says, it didn't happen. I think we put the Sutherland Commission to one side, and from a narrow Treasury perspective, I think there was just a view, look, let's sort out the NHS first and then come back to social care. But as we will no doubt come back to, the problem further down the line, once the 5 years of money, which OneNurse effectively recommended, ran out, and indeed he had proposed that there was a case for having another sort of regular OneNurse type review, it happened to coincide with the worst banking crisis in the last 100 years, and suddenly the government had a huge shortage of money.
Just as you were becoming permanent secretary, I understand, in 2007.
I became permanent secretary in 2005, so I'm one of the guilty men who was failed to see the crisis coming and prepare for it. But you know, the one thing that OneNurse Review did achieve, which I think is the most important thing, is it actually helped build a consensus for more spending, and also therefore enabled, I think, the only discretionary tax increase I can remember in my working life. It allowed Gordon Brown to announce a 1% increase in national insurance, both paid for by employers and employees, which brought in a serious amount of money, which did help what was a pretty extraordinary settlement of 7% real increase year by year by year. Which at the start of the process, I thought we were never going to spend that amount of money, but we did.
And then there was this national insurance hike, which I think you described, Nick, if I'm right, in Nick Timmins's report as soft hypothecation. Was it you or was it Nick Timmins who described it as that?
I think I may have described it as that. It was basically linking the increase in national insurance to the increase in spending. The reality is that money flows into the Treasury, it's in some huge slush fund, And so linking taxes to particular lines of spending isn't really a credible strategy for the long term. But politics is all about, selling an idea to a sceptical electorate. But the reaction was positive. Yes, people had to pay more tax, but they knew the NHS was getting more money. And the cumulative effect of that spending, the waiting times did come down. There was definite progress. I mean, you can argue, coming back to an East point earlier, that the Treasury didn't quite get all its conditions for the extra funding fulfilled because Alan Milburn, I think at the time, wasn't particularly inclined to listen to what Gordon Brown had to say to him. And as a result, and sadly, in my view, a lot of the money just went on across the board pay rises when we were looking for a serious step up in volumes of operations and so on. But it did make a difference. And the NHS, I think by the end of that decade, was in a much more secure state than it had been 10 years earlier.
Yes. And just while you're there, Nick, can you just remind us what the economy was doing in that at that point? Because clearly we're not necessarily in the same position now if we were to consider another oneness. So at the end of the 1990s and early 2000, were we awash with...
Yes, the important thing was that in the late 90s, in one of those sort of strange periods, generally getting revenue in is really difficult. But for various reasons, which I won't trouble you with, in the late 90s, suddenly the government was awash with revenue. Revenues were coming in faster than expected. And I can tell you that since that period, that simply hasn't been the case. The economy was growing. At that time, wages of people in work were rising quite rapidly compared to inflation. And the Treasury was benefiting from that. That began to change through the early part of the next decade. The economy was still growing, but wages weren't rising so rapidly and revenues were tending to disappoint. And Brown was running a budget surplus, I mean, which only happened twice in my lifetime, in round about the turn of the century, but quite rapidly this disappeared. People now look back on New Labour and think that actually they didn't spend very much on social programs. The reality is they did. They were intervening a lot in the labour market with transfer payments and tax credits. And the increase in spending on the NHS was unprecedented. The problem from about 2003 onwards was that the revenues weren't really coming in so quickly as to pay for all of these things. I mean, I don't subscribe to the view that, you know, we ended up with a big deficit because of spending. Actually, we ended up with a big deficit because of a banking crisis. The banking crisis fundamentally changed the relationship between the basic economic relationships in the economy. In particular, the economy stopped growing so quickly. But up until 2008, you know, in a normal year, the economy would grow by something like 2.25%. And there would be extra revenue to spend on priorities. After 2008, the economy simply didn't grow, productivity didn't grow, and wages didn't grow after taking into account inflation. And this made funding services far more challenging.
Thank you for that. So let's go back, Anita, but we'll talk in a minute about what the Department of Health then did with the sudden largesse. But in terms of the oneness review itself, apart from the extra money and the tax hike, justifying that, what did it specifically say about what needed to be done with extra money? How far did it go?
Well, what oneness did, because it was part of the agreement with DH that it wouldn't look at the management of the NHS. So it did not look at the management of the NHS. It didn't look at the organisation. But what it did was set out and develop and set out three scenarios, which were for different futures that healthcare could take. And the one it recommended was this idea of a fully engaged scenario, it's called, yeah, which is a world in which you had a what we would now call integrated care. So a real focus on earlier diagnosis, out of hospital treatment, prevention, and a big emphasis on public health. It was called engaged as well because Derek Wallace was a banker, so he came from a view that actually there'd been in the middle of actually a technology revolution in services, which meant that individuals were doing lots of things which previously services did. So, you know, now we all take online and mobile banking and all of those things for granted. And the NHS hadn't really embraced that. And it wasn't set up to, if you like, help people to help themselves. And that's quite interesting now, in, if you think we're 20 years on from that, but COVID in essence has supercharged some of that with the use of digital services. But it's 2021 and we're still in it, on the back of a pandemic, still struggling with quite what the operating model is for a healthcare services. And he was envisaging that, and that all of that unlocking a lot of real productivity improvement with a lot of investment in capital. And so his view was that you needed this period of very high increase in funding to put in place all the enablers. So he'd argued for a lot of money into IT, a lot of focus then on public health. And then once you'd got all of those foundations in place, you would still need to grow funding, and grow funding at a higher rate probably than inflation and GDP, but not on a sustained 6-7, because you'd have a different model of healthcare which was fundamentally more efficient. The result then was that actually perversely, I think, it did end up rather locking in, if you like, an acute hospital model and a rather, if you like, old-fashioned view of healthcare. And probably for sort of the last 10 years, aside from finally getting to grips with how to get those productivity savings out, we've also been trying to work out how to make a reality of that integrated care model, which it turns out is really quite hard, even if you've got a lot of cash.
Yes. So in fact, so Wanless gave some contours about how he thought the money could be spent in broad terms, as you describe. But as David Nicholson, who was interviewed by Nick Timmins, said that at the time, he put it quite fruitily, he said the Department of Health was, quote, a wholly owned subsidiary of Number 10 at the time, and Wanless belonged to the Treasury. The Department of Health simply said thank you for the money and goodbye and got on with its own plan, which, as you describe, Anita, actually took the form of the NHS plan, didn't it, with more staff and pay and the kinds of things that you mentioned. But some good things, I mean, from memory, if you think about the national service frameworks you mentioned, the other quality measures, and as Nick said, the median waits went down dramatically. I mean, who would have thought that was possible, that never lists could go down in that way? The never lists were those people who were just permanently waiting, as it seemed. And Nick describes hip waits going down from 7 months to 78 days. So, and also public opinion and satisfaction improved, and it neutralized the politics for a bit, because if you remember the 2005 election, the Conservatives went very quiet on funding at that point, having really been in full throttle in previous elections about the NHS's failures. So that was a kind of result, wasn't it? But going back to something that Nick said earlier, Nick, you said that Wanless recommended to repeat this kind of modelling every 5 years, which would make sense to update it, but also because data improves. And why do you think there hasn't been clearly there wasn't one because of the crash, but financial crash. But why do you think we've not really, why was this, has been such a one-off?
I think because governments have been very resource constrained, and the risk of initiating a review like this is it could come up with a recommendation rather similar to the last one. Certainly governments since 2010 have been right of center governments, committed generally to reducing the size of the state until Mr. Johnson became prime minister. And so this was a question they didn't really want answered. I mean, from time to time, the Independent Office for Budgetary Responsibility does long-term projections, and they've done some very good work actually on the pressures on health and social care and drawing in demography and so on. Governments have preferred a rather more drip-feed approach, where you try and sort of hold a line on NHS spending for as long as you can, and then inevitably you get sort of small dams which burst, and, you know, whether it's Theresa May or David Cameron, someone announces more money. But What you haven't had is a focus on the next 5 years. The OBR tend to look sort of 20, 30 years out. I mean, most of public spending is really quite dull and actually relatively unimportant, because compound growth has just meant that health is a very large chunk of it. So I do think it would be good to have reviews which set out the baseline pressures on the NHS, and then in an ideal world, the political parties at general election time would set out what their plans are and what that means for taxation. But maybe I'm being too optimistic about having a high quality debate.
I suppose there's one argument, which is having a published report where everyone kicks the tires on a model of supply and demand and looks 20 years out, and you can then debate. And I can see how that could be difficult politically. Generally, how do things work? And forgive my ignorance here. Are these models occurring, but they're just not published in the Treasury or the Department of Health? Or is the sort of decision-making on the budget for the NHS more of an art with some arm wrestling involved?
Primarily the latter. I wish the Treasury had maintained the one-list model. I'm quite certain that Anita handed it over ready for us to use it well into the future. But it's in the nature of these things that officials and politicians have short memories. I mean, my sense of NHS funding in recent years is it's generally been fairly short-term, focused on dealing with immediate crises. And now, obviously, we have a crisis which makes all previous crises look the proverbial vicarage tea party. But if ever there was a time when we should have a debate as part of the reconstruction following COVID, I believe it is now, because the one thing we know we're all going to agree following this crisis is that our social care home sector is really very underfunded.
Yeah, and elsewhere in the forest, you know, for defence, the integrated defence review, for the infrastructure, you know, the plan for growth has 600 billion over 6 years. Someone somewhere is doing these kinds of calculations, even if they're mainly for capital. Anita, what hope is there for more quantitative basis, an objective basis to the modelling, and secondly, more transparency to enable more people to kick the tyres?
I think the OBR is an important development in that number of governments now, I think over the last at least 15 years, have realised that governments aren't left, especially when they leave big long-term decisions to the political process alone, we often end up making suboptimal decisions that kind of is in no one's interest. But it's a bit of a prisoner's dilemma. You know, most politicians want to break out of that, but they can't see how to. And the temptation of a bit of crude electioneering at the other's expense in that moment is too great. And so they have progressively tried to take some of these decisions, you know, the independence of the Bank of England, the OBR recognising that trust in government forecasts is really, really important on climate change. We're doing that on infrastructure. We're trying to do that as well. I guess what we saw with COVID is that it was over a 10-year period. We tried to borrow your phrase that you often talk about, run our system incredibly hot, at the edge, if not slightly beyond. And we got away with that for a few years. But we had then no buffer and no resilience in the system. And then COVID hit. And, you know, we built the Nightingales and discovered that it is possible. And if you're prepared to pay, you can get oxygen and you can get PPE. Difficult, but you can. But what you can't do is magic up an anaesthetist or a theatre nurse. These people and actually proved to be a real problem. And it was a problem for our health. But also, actually, it meant it was a problem economically, because it meant then that our buffer for any COVID, if we're going to protect the NHS, yeah, we have to do more extreme measures, harsher lockdowns with the economic consequences. So I think the thing that hopefully this has taught us is that healthcare is part of our critical national infrastructure. And obviously, it's very unlikely that we get COVID again. And one of the things we've discovered in risk planning is we were perfectly prepared for flu, you know, and you don't want to be perfectly prepared for the previous crisis. But nevertheless, as I understand it, most of the science is saying linked to, that we are likely to get more incidents of extreme infectious disease, and we need a system that's more resilient to that. And you just don't create resilience overnight.
Well, yes, because I guess if you don't have the money, you don't have a long-term settlement, you can't make some bold, bold changes of the type that might be productivity enhancing, for example, technologies. Not only do you not mitigate risk, downside risk, but you don't take the opportunities for upside risk either. And Nick, Anita just gave a very good case why you might want to invest in a more resilient health service, healthcare infrastructure. But of course, the other thing we saw in the pandemic was that the health fabric of the nation over the last 10 years had frayed as well, for some of the reasons I think you outlined earlier, you know, poverty and the fact that health was a growth in life expectancy was stalling more in Britain than any other European nation. And I think we were only surpassed by the US. So, I mean, that really, you then think about investments in the wider determinants of health, don't you? Like housing, education, early years support. If only, not because it's the right thing, but if only because it might be linked to economic prosperity in future. Do you think that argument is people are warmer to that argument because of the pandemic, or do you think that's just virtuous thinking, which is fiction?
Well, I think there's definitely a cycle in these things. Just as public opinion was up for spending more on the health service back in 2001, too, I think it will be up for it now. And a strategic politician in charge of the government would actually see this as an opportunity, the better to invest in the future. I mean, you could look, I'm not saying you can't borrow to fund these things, but there are limits to how much you can borrow. One of the problems with, I think it's true in all democracies, quite frankly, it's always tempting to think it's a particularly British problem, is that politicians do like to promise the earth, whilst at the same time claiming that they don't actually have to raise taxes to pay for all of these things. You know, you can pay for it out of efficiency, you can pay for it out of all these bureaucrats, you can get rid of those, you know, usual sort of, and free up the front line while you're about it. I think there will be opportunities, and it's always easy to be dismissive about governments. Actually, sometimes governments can do really good things and can, to Anita's point, plan for the future. You know, it's a little known fact that in the 1950s, the government bought a huge amount of spare capacity in fire engines, green goddesses they were called, because of the threat of a nuclear war. Now, as it happens, there wasn't a nuclear war, and those green goddesses only became useful when the firefighters went on strike. But it was an example of the government actually doing sensible forward planning. And like Anita, I think in the future, the NHS will have to have more spare capacity. It is striking if you look at healthcare systems, say in Germany or Austria, how much capacity there is. Now that comes at a price. You know, Austria spends probably 10% more of its national income on taxation. And there is a consensus for doing that. I mean, Britain's always had this slight problem that we kind of want to have a European welfare state paid for it with American-type taxes. You cannot square that circle.
So I guess if we all agree that modelling can be useful, and perhaps this now is the time, there is a moment now, do you think the value of it would be to try to persuade the Treasury and possibly central government to invest in that kind of thing? Or do you think it's more of an independent body's role to do this? I mean, Anita, you advised the Lords Commission, didn't you, on securing the future long-term funding of the NHS and care system?
So I am a fan of some independence. I think the experience of bodies like the Office of Budget Responsibility and the Bank of England, and actually the ONS has been made independent as well. And I think all of that is very important, and especially in an era where trust in politicians is pretty low. People want to know that analysis is robust. But you can't decide government spending on the NHS by an independent body. You know, we are a democracy. You know, it is ultimately for any government in a democracy to determine how much is spent and how it's paid for. What an independent body would do is two things. I mean, one, I think it would make it much harder to engage in Alice in Wonderland funding settlements that say, here's a very modest rate of growth, but with that rate of growth, we are going to do the following amazing things that are absolutely world class. And every government I can remember pretty much has fallen into that trap. So, you know, that is, so I think a bit of transparency and accountability about just what's involved is quite important. The other thing I think which is quite important is the NHS faces a lot of below the radar of these big political choices, quite important service planning decisions day in, day out, you know, which have long-term consequences. So the decisions about this aren't just for in the big set pieces of a spending review. You know, we need to decide how much to put in primary care, which part versus in hospital services, which parts of the country, all those sorts of things. And actually, it's easy to miss that there are these underlying trends that accumulate that actually can have quite a big impact on what the right mix is. And at the moment, that's done with no transparency. And a lot of the decisions that are taken by different bodies within the NHS family. And just being able to say to people then, well, actually, you know, this doesn't, you know, this set of decisions and that set of decisions, they don't obviously add up. You know, do we mean that? Are we sure about that? That's the value, I think, of this sort of body.
Yes. Penultimate question to Nick is, if there were such a one list or an OBR type, you know, better modelling, would that automatically, do you think, lead to government wanting to have more control over the NHS than if it were just kind of hand-to-mouth usual combat?
Very hard to tell. Sensible governments know what to delegate and what not. And I'm not sure running the NHS out of Whitehall is the answer to any problem. In fact, I would strongly advocate greater devolution and decentralisation, in particular to enable budgets to be shared between social care and the NHS and to have integrated approaches. But
hallelujah to that, may I say.
Well,
thank
indeed.
You.
But I travel, hopefully. But I don't expect any great change in the coming period. Perhaps I'm being a bit pessimistic, though.
Well, let's see whether we have a new Secretary of State to contend with, Elizabeth. So maybe I can just ask your very last question, which is a very simple one, which is it now time for another one list? What would be your response?
Yes, I think it is to kick off a process. And I think it is because actually COVID does raise really very fundamental questions about the sort of capacity and infrastructure that we need, how you manage that to be more resilient. I think that is a very specific question, but I hope coming out of that, whereas Derek Wanless recommended that his review began a new way of thinking about this, and that didn't happen. But this time, the next review does begin a new way of thinking about this and seed an architecture to do that.
So we must leave it there. I'd like to thank our two guests, Anita Charlesworth and Nick McPherson, for a really rich discussion of these issues and a possible way forward as we face recovery from the pandemic, and indeed as we face a spending review in the autumn. For links to key reading on this subject, there is a rollicking good read of the Wanless Review, How It Came About, The Politics and What Was the Impact, by Nick Timmins. The report is called The Most Expensive Breakfast in History and can be found on our website and in our show notes wherever you find this podcast. We'll be turning back to health and exploring the place in the UK where life expectancy is lowest and where one in four men will die before their 65th birthday, Glasgow. What is fraying health to this degree? Until then, that's all, folks. See you next time.